reminder, welcome. It's Catholic Answers Live. Jerry Usher in for Cy Kellett today. Thursdays for many, many years have meant your questions and Catholic Answers Live on the radio. So get on board with a faith question, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Obviously, the first one's on the line. You get to go first here. We got 2 hours coming your way. Senior apologist Jimmy Akin is here in hour number one, and Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press, will be answering the questions in hour number two. So please do join us, 888-318-7884. The entire show team is standing by. And I believe Marie is screening your calls today, so she is fast, friendly, and efficient. She'll get you lined up right away. And as I said, Jimmy Akin is here for the first hour. Jimmy, welcome. Good to be with you again, second time this week.
Thank you so much, Jerry. Likewise.
Yeah. You know what? It's some great feasts today. You know, St. Valentine, you know.
You order
we
pizza
celebrate.
Or something?
What's that?
You order pizza for your feast or something?
I don't know. But, you know, I went to Mass, you know, and I don't ever really remember St. Valentine being, you know, his feast day that often. Usually it's Cyril and Methodius. Is there a reason why they would be prioritized that you know of?
Well, there's a the church has a system of ranking holy days, and it varies from one region to another in part. But it also varies in part based on the choices of the celebrant, because there are a lot of memorials that are optional. And consequently, whether or not they get celebrated or which optional memorial gets celebrated on a particular day is up to the celebrant of the liturgy to decide. And so that could be a reason for it in this case, though to be sure I'd have to look at a document called the General Norms or sometimes called the Universal Norms for the liturgical year and the calendar, which has a table of days and their respective ranks.
Okay. Well, folks, whatever you prefer to celebrate today, St. Valentine or St. Cyril and Methodius, and I'm sure if you checked the online websites about saints, there's probably a whole lot of other saints who are maybe lesser known but are having a feast celebrated today. It's just great to be Catholic and to be able to honor and remember our older brothers and sisters in the faith.
Yeah. By the way, Jerry, since you mentioned that it's Valentine's Day, I thought I'd mention something that I'm going to do on Facebook after I get off the show today. You know, Valentine's Day is a day that's often connected with romance. And even if it's not connected with romance, people often exchange Valentines platonically. But there are some people in life who don't, you know, have anybody who's going to give them a Valentine this year. And it can be sometimes a little disappointing. So on Facebook, after I get off the show today, I'm going to put up a Valentine for everybody who hasn't already got one. And
very nice.
I want to share that with everybody who's listening in the same sense. So if you haven't yet gotten a Valentine today, consider you have received one from me over the radio.
Very nice. That's very nice of you, Jimmy. So, folks, be watching Jimmy's Facebook page for that sometime after the program today. In the meantime, we are going to take your questions at 888-318-7884. When I say we, I mean Jimmy. So we're going to start with David in Rochester, listening on the Station of the Cross. Hi, David. You're numero uno on our program today. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Jerry and Jimmy. It's a pleasure to talk to you tonight. I was reading Matthew 19, and I think I might get this a little bit wrong, but the Pharisees were asking Jesus to explain about whether divorce is allowed or not. And then Jesus says, you know, referring back to Genesis, he says, don't you understand from the beginning, you know, God created man and woman, therefore, you know, marriage should never be, or it should never be allowed to have divorce. But then I think it's in 19:9 where Jesus again says, no man should divorce except for unchastity. So when I did a little research on that, the study guide said that it was, the unchastity meant incest, but when I look up that word, it really refers back to porneia, which is a Greek word, and I think it's for pornography. So confused as to how Jesus said it's never allowed, because that's from Genesis, it wasn't allowed, but then there was an exception,
okay.
And it's causing quite a conundrum for me to really grip that.
So this is a familiar issue. There are a number of different understandings of this text. Now, one of the common ones, and you especially hear this in some circles with our separated brethren, they'll translate the word porneia in this passage as adultery. So it'll say something like, except for adultery. And that then gets taken as a permission to divorce someone if they've committed adultery, and then you would be free to marry somebody else, as if adultery somehow broke the marital union. But that's not consistent with what we have in the text itself, because what Jesus says in Matthew 19:9 is, "And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for porneia and marries another commits adultery." And so he indicates that if you divorce your wife, even if it was for porneia, understood as adultery, and you marry another, then that results in an ongoing adultery. And similarly, he says he who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. And so he doesn't add any qualifiers about, oh, unless that woman was divorced in the case of an adulterous union, in which case her marriage is broken and it's okay to marry her. He indicates that it would be adultery regardless of the circumstances of the woman's previous marriage. And that's indicated by other passages in the New Testament, including in Mark and in Luke and in Romans, where Paul simply says, you're bound to your spouse for as long as you live. This is assuming, of course, that there's a valid marriage in the first place. So if there's adultery, it breaks the marriage and you're free to remarry someone else interpretation doesn't fit with the data of the text itself. It is possible, though, to understand porneia here as a reference to adultery, because porneia, it doesn't mean pornography. Pornography is a related English word, so they have a common root, but they actually mean something different. And porneia is a broad word, and it does include things like adultery as well as other forms of unchastity. Even if you said, well, what Jesus means here is except for adultery, that wouldn't give you permission to remarry. Many of the church fathers looked at this passage and said, okay, if you divorce your wife, and you that's going to result in and this is even clearer in if you look at the parallel in Mark and in Luke. But if you divorce your wife for any reason other than adultery, you're causing her to become an adulteress. But you wouldn't be causing her to become an adulteress if she's already committed adultery, because in that case, she's already an adulteress, so you're not making her an adulteress by divorcing her. She already has achieved that on her own. The one difficulty with that interpretation is that porneia is not the ordinary Greek word for adultery. There is a specific word for adultery. It's moicheia. And as you can hear by the sound of the word, it's a different word. And so presumably Jesus does not mean simply adultery here. He means something that's a little more complex than that. The fact that this is found that these exceptive clauses are found only in Matthew, the except for porneia clauses, they're found only in Matthew 19 and only in Matthew 5. And they're not found anywhere else in the New Testament. And some people have said, well, that may be related to the fact that Matthew's gospel is written for an audience of Jewish Christians. And consequently, it may have to do with an issue that would arise in Jewish circles, but not in Gentile circles. And that's what leads to the incest interpretation that you ran across. What some people have suggested is, well, there are certain kinds of marriage that are expressly forbidden in the Mosaic law. You're not allowed to marry certain of your relatives and so forth. And as a result of that, those marriages would be invalid. And so it would be perfectly fine and indeed mandatory in those cases to divorce such a person because the marriage itself is forbidden and invalid. So some people have said, well, maybe that's what Jesus has in mind here. Maybe it's these marriages that would be forbidden by the law of Moses. That would be an issue that would come up in Jewish circles, but it wouldn't really come up in Gentile circles. And so because it's kind of hard to summarize these forbidden marriages in a short space in English. We don't really have a word for these types of marriages. But since they involve relatives, some people will just use the word incest as a kind of catch-all term to refer to these marriages. And so there are arguments along those lines. There's also another reason, though, that Matthew, among all of the Gospels, might be inclined to include an exceptive clause here to acknowledge the fact that at least in some circumstances, divorce is permissible. And that's because Matthew alone talks about the fact that Joseph initially planned to divorce Mary when he learned that she was pregnant by the Holy Spirit. And so he immediately, upon mentioning the fact that Joseph had planned to divorce Mary originally, stressed the fact that Joseph was a righteous man, and so he planned to put her away quietly or to divorce her quietly rather than subjecting her to public shame. But then, given the fact he needs to include Jesus' own teachings about divorce, it would raise the question in the reader's mind, well, how was Joseph a righteous man if Jesus says we're not supposed to divorce at all? And so that's led some people to propose that Matthew mentioned the exceptive clauses to indicate that there are some circumstances in which it would be permissible to divorce. And one of them that I haven't mentioned up to this point that some people have proposed and that would apply to a situation like Joseph and Mary's is when two people have been legally married, they become betrothed in Jewish society, but they haven't yet begun cohabiting. This is a custom that existed in the ancient Jewish world where people would legally contract marriage and then wait for an extended period of time, maybe a year, before they began to cohabit. And then at the end of that time period, the husband would come and they'd have a big ceremony known as the fetching of the bride ceremony, where the husband would come to the household of his legal wife and then take her back to his own household, and they would begin to live together as husband and wife. And so at that point, the marriage was not consummated, and thus the one flesh union between man and woman had not been achieved. And the Catholic Church even today would say, if you haven't consummated, it's not going to be completely indissoluble. There are situations where an unconsummated marriage can be dissolved. And so that, some have proposed, is what Matthew is thinking of here, because Joseph and Mary had been legally married, but they had not yet begun to cohabit. And so it was during that intermediate period that Joseph heard about Mary's pregnancy and could have assumed that she had been unfaithful and therefore could have divorced her in this period on those grounds. And that would be consistent with the understanding of marriage and divorce that Jesus has. So there are a number of possibilities about what Matthew means here. Some of them are better than others. The church doesn't have a definitive teaching on which one of these options is correct, but it is a subject that's very interesting, and I have some discussion of it in my book, in a brief way, in my book, A Daily Defense. I also did a talk on all of these options few years ago at our Catholic Answers conference on marriage. So you might check out the MP3s of that conference.
Okay, David, I hope that helps. We have got a bunch of folks to get to here on the program. So thanks for your call from Rochester, and thanks for listening to the Station of the Cross. Thursday, Q&A open forum. Jimmy Akin here this hour, Mark Brumley in hour number two. And by the way, no surprise that the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers includes questions on divorce and remarriage, end-of-life issues, faith and science, angels and demons, salvation, the Eucharist, abortion, scripture and tradition, miracles, Mary, you name it. And, you know, Lent is a great time for us to challenge ourselves. We really want to dig a little bit deeper in our faith lives. And Catholic Answers is making that oh so easy for you and very, very economically attractive as well. It's the 20 Answers Challenge. Here's how it works. Hundreds have already signed up for this, and we invite you to do that prior prior to March 6th. That's when Lent begins. And when you purchase the sampler of all 32 books in the 20 Answers series, you're going to save 60% off the normal price. And Catholic Answers is challenging you to finish them all during Lent and Easter. Lent, again, begins on March 6th. And you're also going to get free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Jimmy, these are very digestible and, you know, nothing at all wrong with maybe using something more of a faith nature rather than, say, devotional, or mixing this in with your devotionals during Lent.
Absolutely not. It's always good to learn more about the faith and thus more about God.
So, call today, 888-291-8000, or you can log on to the shop at Catholic.com. And don't be left out, okay? If your friends and family are joining the 20 Answers Challenge for Lent and Easter, we invite you to do that as well. Shop.Catholic.com or 888-291-8000. Okay, we're going to go next to Canada to talk to Ken when we come back, and Tom and Craig and Dominic and the others. So stay with us here on Catholic Answers Live.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is proudly supported by CatholicChemistry.com, a new dating site for Catholics who want to do dating right and believe relationships start with Catholic chemistry. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicChemistry.com for their generous support on the web at CatholicChemistry.com.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
He was a doctor of the church and one of the most famous saints of all time.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Augustine is honored for his immense contributions to theology, but he balanced his genius with humility. He once declared, "It was pride that changed angels into devils. It is humility that makes men as angels." He died in 461.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Here, Jerry Usher in for Cy Kellett. Good to be working with Jimmy Akin again this hour, and we're going to help Ken next. He's in St. Albert, Canada, listening to the program on the Catholic Answers Live app. Hello, Ken. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi, Ken. You're on the air. What's your question?
Yes. Question for you. I've got an 18-year-old son who likes to kind of quiz me, question me on different doctrines and teachings of the Catholic Church, and we had a discussion about the gender, and specifically about the gender reassignment surgery, and he's asking as to why that, you know, there's such a problem with it, you know, in the Catholic Church, and then we sort of like we discussed that, you know, it's because of the mutilation of the body issue, and then he mentioned, well, how about tattooing? How about plastic surgeries, even for vanity reasons? And then, you know, so like there is obviously different levels of this mutilation. And at some point there is a line in the sand where, you know, it becomes problematic. And I'm just wondering, how do I kind of go about explaining it to him?
So there's a difference between mutilation and surgery. And not everything that involves the physical alteration of the body constitutes mutilation. Mutilation occurs when one substantially interferes with the normal operations of the body. Merely making a cut does not do that. In fact, it's actually rather necessary that we perform some cutting. I mean, like, we all need to cut our fingernails from time to time or they're going to get ingrown. Same thing with our toenails. And so our bodies are just designed in a way that requires some alteration of them. And the question is, are we interfering with or promoting the proper operation of our bodies by doing that? In the case of tattooing, there's nothing about tattooing, if it's done correctly, that interferes with the operation of your body. It's just coloring the skin, which is not dissimilar to putting on makeup. It's just of a more permanent nature. And so consequently, tattooing doesn't fall under the mutilation prohibition because it doesn't harm the ability of your body to function. Similarly, plastic surgery doesn't do that if it's done properly. What gender reassignment surgery does, though, is interfere with the proper operation of your body, because you're disabling, among other things, you're disabling the ability of your body's reproductive system to function. And so consequently, it would be like having another important organ removed. And so consequently, that's why gender reassignment surgery would count as a form of mutilation, whereas things like merely cosmetic surgery or tattooing would not.
What do you think, Ken? Is that helpful?
No, that sounds good.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Thanks for listening there in St. Albert, Canada. Okay, next to Tom in Ohio, listening to Catholic Answers Live on Sirius XM 130. Hi, Tom. You're on with Jimmy Akin.
Thank you. My question concerns laicization in the Catholic Church of any of the clerics. After that process takes place, does the cleric still get paid by the church, and is housing still given to that cleric?
Typically, no. When someone is laicized or canonically returned to the lay state, they no longer minister on behalf of the church, and they typically are not, and consequently, they're not going to be paid for services they're not rendering. Having said that, there could be cases where an arrangement might be made where if someone is being laicized and they would be indigent, you know, they'd be out on the street, then as a matter of compassion, the church might give them some kind of a stipend or allowance, but it's not going to be payment. It would just be a humanitarian gesture to help the person be able to keep body and soul together in an environment where he's no longer functioning as a cleric. My understanding, though, is even that is rare, if it occurs at all. I'm not aware of any cases where that's occurring, but I could imagine that in some cases a humanitarian provision might be made along those lines, but it wouldn't be payment because the person's no longer performing any services. It would just be a charity gesture to someone who would otherwise be indigent.
I see. Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
You're welcome, Tom. Glad we can help you with that. Next, we're going to Trabuco Canyon, California, and Craig listening on the EWTN app. Hello, Craig. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Hello, Craig?
I can...
Craig?
Hello, can you hear me?
You're cutting in and out a little
if
bit.
If you could talk right into the phone.
Okay, how's that?
That's better. What's your question?
Okay, my question is, hope I can frame this up right. So in the Bible, we read where Jesus did miracles and was resurrected and all the great things that he did. But do we ever read, and is there any literature out there from the Romans or from the Jews where they rebuke it? In other words, we hear about all these beautiful things that he did, and there's different religions and groups of people that say that it never happened. But is there anything historically that they ever wrote about it, rebuking it, if that makes sense?
Are you looking specifically for things that are said by non-Christian sources that criticize Christianity, or are you looking for just things that acknowledge Jesus's existence?
I think existence, okay. In other words.
Yeah, there are passages in various Jewish and Roman sources that mention Jesus. The Jewish historian Josephus mentions Jesus in a couple of places. In one of them, it's unfortunate, there has been some editing by a later Christian scribe that makes exactly what Josephus said about Jesus in that passage somewhat uncertain, but although scholars still have a pretty good idea of what he originally said. In the other passage, there's no doubt about what Josephus said. He's talking about Jesus's well-known quote-unquote brother, James the Just, and he mentions that James the Just was a quote-unquote brother of Jesus. So he mentions him a second time there. The Roman historians Tacitus and Suetonius both mention Jesus, at least in passing, sometimes with a little bit more detail in Tacitus. There are other sources, like there's a Syrian author named Mara Bar Sarapian that mentions that Jesus existed. And there are other reasons we have as well to conclude that Jesus existed based on what we know from these other early sources, even if they don't mention Jesus himself, they will mention Christians. And we can show from first and very early second century sources that Christianity was all over the place by the beginning of the second century. But by Christians' own admission, it didn't exist before the AD 30s. And so that meant that Christianity had to grow from nothing around AD 30 to being all over the Roman world by 70 years later. And that means that it had to have an organized, very energetic evangelization campaign to spread itself that far. It had a strong missionary impulse. And the only way you have a movement that gets started and gets organized enough to spread itself in that way is if it had some kind of charismatic founder that gave it its missionary mandate. You don't just have people sitting around forming a social club deciding to spread themselves in that way, especially not in the ancient world when travel was so difficult. That's something I've written about. So if you Google Jimmy Akin, did Jesus exist, you'll come up with information about all that.
All right, Craig, glad we can help you with that. Break time here on Catholic Answers Live. I am Jerry Usher in for Cy Kellett. Jimmy has got a long way to go this hour, and Mark Brumley will answer your questions in hour number two. So we have a long way to go today on this Thursday Q&A Open Forum program. We're glad you're with us.
Catholic Answers Live.
Is the Church wrong on contraception? In a culture that worships the pursuit of sexual pleasure, the Catholic Church's teaching on contraception can seem archaic and unintelligible. Its critics say it's outdated, theologically unfounded, and even harmful. And even faithful Catholics can have difficulty explaining this moral teaching. Catholic Answers is out to change all of that. That's why we've just released Trent Horn's dynamic new DVD, The Case Against Contraception. Using scripture, papal and magisterial teachings, natural law, and new insights provided by social science and medicine, Trent puts forward a compelling case for Catholic teachings with his trademark charity and persuasive graciousness. Be prepared to give a defense. Order your copy of The Case Against Contraception today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Author Mark McNeil spent years in the Oneness Pentecostal movement, praying in its lively services, zealously spreading its unconventional teachings, and rejecting mainstream Christianity as misguided. Then he left it all behind. All in the Name is the story of a man who believed he was among an elite group of believers who followed the true faith when so many others had strayed. But an inquisitive mind, careful study, and the action of the Holy Spirit finally led Mark out of Oneness Pentecostalism and into the Catholic Church. This is an inspiring conversion story you won't want to miss. It's a faith strengthener for Catholics and an intriguing challenge to those who deny the doctrine of the Trinity. Order your copy of All in the Name today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Dr. David Anders. If you just don't understand something about the Catholic faith, Call to Communion is the show for you. Join us Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Appreciate your patience, those of you on the line. And when a line opens up, the number is 888-318-7884 to ask your question of Jimmy Akin or Mark Brumley, depending on when you get on the show. We're going back to New York, and Dominic listening on the Station of the Cross to the program. Hi, Dominic. Welcome.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I recently graduated from PT school, and I just did my first job.
When you say PT school, what does that mean for us lay folks?
Therapy school.
Physical therapy, okay.
Physical therapy, yeah.
Yes, sir. And I just took my first job. During the application process, I was told that I would be exempt from joining the union that the full-time and part-time therapists are a part of. And I just went through orientation, and now I'm being told that I have no choice but to sign the paperwork to join this particular union. This is creating a moral dilemma for me,
mm-hmm.
as they are backers of many political candidates who support now full-term abortion here in the state of New York. And I'm just at a bit of a crossroads as to what I should do. And if,
okay.
So that you can give me...
Yeah. So, Dominic, your phone connection is kind of fading in and out, but I got enough to be able, I think, to answer your question. It's unfortunate that they're requiring you to do this. I hope that there are other opportunities for you to, in the future, to be able to avoid this, you know, other jobs you could take that don't have this requirement and so forth. Having said that, Catholic moral theology would not hold that you have to say no to this. It's in principle legitimate to join unions. That doesn't mean one always should do so or that it's always the best idea, but workers do have the right to unionize. And so consequently, joining a union is not something that is in itself immoral. Now, what if a union then does bad things? Well, at that point, you have to apply what are known as the principles of cooperation with evil, because in this world, all of us are sinners. And consequently, anytime you cooperate with another human being, you're cooperating with someone who at some point, at some time, will do evil. And that means that that cooperation with people who do evil is unavoidable. And this is something that we really cannot escape as part of the Christian life. Even if we tried to isolate ourselves from other human beings and from interacting with other human beings, we wouldn't be there may be a few people who have a special calling towards more intense forms of isolated life, but most people do not have that calling. And even the people who do have such a calling typically need human contact in one way or another, and that means cooperating with other sinful people. And so because cooperation with people who do things that are wrong is unavoidable, Catholic moral theologians have reflected on the conditions that allow that cooperation to be legitimate versus when it becomes illegitimate. One of the principles is you must not yourself approve of the evil that is being done. And since you're objecting to various things that the union is involved in, it's clear that condition is fulfilled in your case. Also, you must not yourself directly do something evil. And just by being a member of a union and paying dues to that union, that's not evil in and of itself. So you wouldn't be doing anything that is in and of itself evil. Another principle is that any involvement you have with an evil act needs to be remote, meaning you're not directly doing it. And so in this case, if you're not – even if some portion of your union dues is being taken by the union and being spent on something it shouldn't be spent on, well, that's not in principle different than buying a pizza and having the pizza delivery guy take part of his wages, which came from your money, and, you know, buying porn with it or something like that. Your involvement at that point is remote. You didn't make the decision for him to do that. You didn't approve of the decision. You didn't say, here, take this money and go do evil with it. You weren't directly involved. This was a choice that was out of your hands and that you had only remote connection with. And so consequently, it can be legitimate in such circumstances, assuming that there's assuming the other conditions in the situation, like you need a job and this is the job that's available to you and you need to join the union in order to be able to get this job, it can be legitimate to go ahead and join, even knowing that the union, like any other group you're involved with, is going to do some things that it shouldn't at some point.
Does that help, Dominic? Give you a little peace of mind?
It does. I appreciate you guys taking the time and all that you do for us that listen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for being a physical therapist. I recently took advantage of some of those services near where I live, and it makes a nice little difference. So good luck to you in your career. All right, to New Jersey, Catholic Answers Live app. By the way, if you haven't downloaded the app, look for it in your app store. You ought to have it on your phone. That's how Tom is listening there in New Jersey. Hi, Tom. You're on with Jimmy Akin.
Hi, big fan, Jimmy. Thanks so much for taking the call.
Thank
you. My question has to do with two parts of the Mass. The first is, how is it decided whether or not the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed is said? Is it just up to the pastor? Is it arbitrary? Or is there a way to figure that out?
It's up to the celebrant.
My question is, it is entirely, so if I go to a new parish or I'm visiting somewhere, there's no way for me to tell until we start saying it?
Well, I mean, it may be announced. I've been at parishes where it'll be announced in the bulletin that, say, during the season of Easter, we're going to say the Apostles' Creed or something like that. You can always ask if it's a source of concern for you.
Okay. All right. Good to know. My second part, really quickly, after the communion, is there a specific time where you're supposed to go from the kneeling position to the sitting position? Because it seems like everybody does it at a different time, whether it be when the altar is cleared or when the Eucharist is put back in the tabernacle or when the priest sits.
And there's no specific point in time. Some people have proposed, oh, well, we ought to do it when the priest sits down or something like that. But that's just personal taste. The church does not have a regulation on this. It wants the faithful to be able to assume whatever posture best facilitates their own communion with God spiritually. And so if you're more comfortable sitting or standing or kneeling following communion, that's up to you.
All right, Tom.
Great. Hey, you have done so much for my faith. Thank you for all that you do. God bless you.
No
God
problem.
Bless you,
thank
Tom.
You.
Yeah, well, for somebody like me, Jimmy, who's had both knees operated on, usually when my knees get sore, you know. Okay, Alan in Ohio watching. Hello. Greetings, Alan. We're waving at you there. I am on YouTube Live. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, Alan.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
All right. So my question is, I'm 19 years old and I'm in college right now. And my sociology teacher told us about a group of primitive humans called the Yanomamo people.
Oh, okay.
And she told us these horrific stories of immoral things that they do to each other. And I was just wondering, since they haven't like evolved that sort of morality or reason behind God existing, do they still have souls?
Yeah. So the Yanomamo are an interesting case. For people who may not be familiar with them, they're a tribal people that lives in Latin America, and they have a reputation for being very fierce. In fact, they're sometimes called the fierce people. And if you read stories about the Yanomamo, yeah, they're quite fierce. They have stuff that's quite violent and, by our standards, quite cruel that goes on in their society. Having said that, they do have morality. Unfortunately, you know, they're sinners like the rest of us, and unfortunately, their culture is one that has not been substantially affected at this point by the Christian love ethic. And so, it is one that is that has cruelty in it from our perspective. And they do, however, have a basic understanding of morality, and they very definitely do have souls. Every living creature has a soul, because the soul is the life principle of the body that keeps a life form alive. In the case of humans, humans have rational souls because we have the gift of reason, and the gift of reason includes a basic understanding of morality, even if it's been distorted by sin or by our living in a particular culture. So the Yanomamo definitely have souls, and hopefully one day they will come to adopt an ethic of more universal love than they have thus far. But even now, they do have an understanding of morality that operates on a certain level. It's just not the fuller Christian understanding of universal love that we have.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome, Alan. Hey, we have an open phone line here. We need somebody on that line. 888-318-7884. Your questions, always fantastic questions, well thought out. And Jimmy Akin giving the answers for the remainder of this hour, and Mark Brumley will do likewise in hour number two. And we'll get to Isabel and Maria and Anita and the others here in just a moment. Want to remind you, too, of something that, you know, we mentioned the 20 Answers Challenge a little bit ago. And Catholic Answers also is offering you a great resource. You can use it now. You could add it to your Lenten regimen, whatever you want. Give it as a gift. In fact, spread the word. It's free, folks, free, F-R-E-E, free. It's an e-book, and it'll help you develop your interior life more fully, more completely, more richly. And as we move towards Lent, it's a brand new e-book from Catholic Answers, and it's called Growing Closer to God. What is the interior life? It's got all kinds of great principles of spirituality and faith and prayer. And I think Michelle Arnold of Catholic Answers, one of their staff apologists, kind of outlines a little do-it-yourself retreat, tells you how you don't have to go too far from home or don't have to go anywhere from home, spend a lot of money, take a lot of time. You can do that if you want. We certainly encourage it. But anyway, this free ebook is available right now at the Catholic Answers Facebook page or at shop.catholic.com. And it's, again, it's titled Growing Closer to God, What is the Interior Life? Now, you don't always get free resources that are going to help transform your life, make you holy, help you get to heaven. So take advantage of this as soon as you can at the Catholic Answers Facebook page or shop.catholic.com. Growing Closer to God, What is the Interior Life? You'll get that question answered and you'll be better off for it. I'm Jerry Usher in for Cy Kellett, and we'll continue right around the corner.
Join us on air today on Catholic Answers Live.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
Fallen away Catholic years and years ago, doing my own thing, and my mom and dad never gave up on me, and I know it was the Holy Rosary, and they kept after me, Philip, pray your rosary, and eventually I did. I'm a member of the Knights of the Immaculata, Maximilian Kolbe's group. I'm with the Legion of Mary, and I haven't stopped leading the rosary in nursing homes, thanks be to God.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Okay, we're going back to your calls in just a minute. I also have been asked to let you in on something that Catholic Answers is doing. It's a wonderful new project that you can get involved in. It's called The Very First Fathers, and it's all about the Church Fathers. Jimmy has a big role in this, as do some of the other Catholic Answers apologists.
No, just me.
Oh, just you?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I should have known. Sorry about the that, Jimmy.
No biggie.
Jimmy talks all about the early church fathers and some of the writings that, you know, you may not have ever been aware of. So tell you what, but tell you more about this maybe next hour. But go to Catholic.com and click on, there's a banner there called Very First Fathers. And you can be a part of this very, very exciting project of learning more about the church fathers yourself and helping others do the same. Okay, Isabel is in San Antonio listening to us on Guadalupe Radio Network. Hello, Isabel. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Thank you, and thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question. A friend of mine, I work at a Jewish community center, mm-hmm. and so they were asking me about that Mary was not a virgin, because in Matthew, I believe chapter 1, mm-hmm. It says something about Joseph not coming to know Mary until the birth of Jesus.
Right. So this is an old claim. It's one that there have been responses to for centuries. I know St. Jerome dealt with this objection back during the AD 300s. There was a gentleman in his day named Helvidius who was making this argument. The verse in question is Matthew 1:25. And Helvidius says, well, it says Joseph didn't know Mary until, and in Greek that's heos, until she gave birth to her son. And so that would imply for Helvidius that Joseph did know or have sexual relations with Mary after this point. And the word until, both in English and in Greek, can sometimes have that implication, that after a particular point in time was reached, that there was a change of circumstance. So in this case, the proposal would be that up until this time, Joseph had not had sexual relations with Mary, but then there was a change of circumstance after this, and so he did have sexual relations with her. That's possible given just the grammar in this passage, but it is not necessary given the grammar in this passage, because the word until, again, both in English and in Greek, does not always indicate there's a change of state. Sometimes it's just a way of saying this did not happen up to this point, and it leaves the question of what happened after this point unaddressed. There are even situations where the context will tell you that the circumstance definitely did not change. A famous example of that is David's wife, Michal, in the Old Testament. If you read the Greek Old Testament, it says that because of the way Michal scorned David's worship of God, she had no children until, and it's the same word in Greek, haos, until the day she died. Well, it does not mean that she then had children after the day she died. It just means she never had children. And so we can see how this word doesn't mandate the change of circumstance interpretation. And that's one of the things that St. Jerome explored in his work Against Helvidius, where he responded to this idea. And he pointed out multiple examples where the Greek word haos did not indicate a change of circumstance after the point in time under discussion was reached. So the grammar here and the word in question doesn't indicate one way or another for sure whether or not they did go on to have sexual relations. Both would be possible just from this passage. But this passage is not the only thing we have. We also have other indications from the Gospel of Luke, from the Gospel of John, from early Christian writings, including ones from the second century, that indicate that Mary did remain a virgin, and consequently, that sheds additional light on the way we ought to interpret Matthew 1:25. So the verse itself can be read more than one way, but then the data from other sources indicates it should be read in a way that's consistent with Mary's perpetual virginity, because that's what's indicated by our other material. And if you want to read more about that, go to Catholic.com and type in Mary and virginity, and a number of resources will come up for you.
Okay, Isabel? Okay, apparently
hope that
she's
helps.
Satisfied. Hope that helps you out. Thanks for calling the program, and we hope that we will hear from you again when you've got another faith question. Okay, Anita is listening to Catholic Answers Live on Iowa Catholic Radio in Des Moines. Hi, Anita. You're on with Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. Thank you so much for taking my call.
No problem.
So I'm in a Bible study led by Edward Sree on the Gospel of John. And today in class, we were talking about, or he was presenting, that God's presence left the temple when it was destroyed by Babylon. He was talking about Jesus' pronouncements during the Feast of Tabernacles and explaining some things. And what struck me and my fellow Bible gals was, if God's presence left the temple when the ark was lost and the temple was destroyed and did not return when the temple was rebuilt, why do we read in the New Testament that they still had a Holy of Holies and they still have the high priests giving special worship in the Holy of Holies if there is no specific presence there?
Well, they could have. So let me be devil's advocate for a moment. Just because they thought God's presence was there doesn't mean it was. So they could rebuild the temple and build a Holy of Holies in it and continue to have the high priests worship there at the appropriate time of year and just be mistaken thinking that God's presence had returned. So you can't look at external behavior as an indication of is God really present or not. That's something God has to reveal to us. In this case, though, God reveals to us that he did return. In fact, it was God who instructed them to rebuild the temple, and we have indications from the New Testament and even from other writings of the first century that God's presence was there and that it left again when no later than when the temple was destroyed again. You have in the New Testament, for example, Jesus endorses worship in the temple. Caiaphas, the high priest, even though he plots the murder of Jesus, it's clear he's still a legitimate high priest of God from John's gospel, because John indicates that Caiaphas unwittingly prophesied about Jesus precisely because he was high priest at the time. So there's a New Testament recognition of the legitimacy of the temple and of the priesthood that implies God's presence there. Notice how Jesus clears the money changers out of the temple because it's meant to be devoted to the worship of God, including by Gentiles, and the money changers were taking up space that was meant to be allotted for Gentiles to worship God in, and thus they were crowding out Gentiles who could have worshiped there, and so they were profaning the temple, and that implies God's in the temple so that it can be profaned, because if it's just a secular spot where God is not present in a special way, that wouldn't apply. We then have in the Gospel of Mark an interesting passage. If you read Mark 15, when Jesus dies, he gives a loud cry, Mark says, and breathes his last. And the next thing Mark says is, and the curtain of the temple that separates the Holy of Holies was torn in two from top to bottom. Now, some people look at that passage and say, oh, so this is giving us access to God without having to go through the Jewish priesthood. And that's a possible interpretation, but the way Mark links it with Jesus's death, it looks more like this is God leaving the temple, because the fact the curtain is torn from the top indicates it's God doing this. God is tearing this. And just as Jesus' spirit has just left his body as he breathed his last, it looks like, and Jesus has identified his body with the temple, as in John, where he says, you know, destroy this temple and in 3 days I'll build it up. So Jesus has identified his body with the temple. Now that Jesus' body is dead, his spirit has left his body, we have the tearing of the temple veil, and that suggests the temple veil is torn not to let us in, but to let God's spirit out. And thus you could look at this passage in Mark as another case of God's presence leaving the temple. We also have indications outside the New Testament. If you read the Jewish historian Josephus, he reports that prior to the temple's destruction in AD 70, one night there was a big commotion of supernatural origin in the temple, and the witnesses heard voices saying, "We are departing from here." And the implication would be God is departing his temple in preparation for its destruction by the Romans, just as, according to Dr. Sri, God's presence departed the temple prior to its destruction by the Babylonians.
How's that, Anita?
Certainly some food for thought. What Dr. Sri said was that they were hoping, that there was a hope voiced by Ezekiel in chapter 47 that God's presence would return again. Mm-hmm. And his point was that there was no presence till Jesus came to the temple.
Well, I haven't heard this course by Dr. Sri, so I can't really comment on that. But I would say, based on Jesus's treatment of the temple and the priesthood as holy, and as being desecrated by the activities of the money changers, as well as the way Mark presents this, I would say, in my opinion, it looks like God had resumed presence in the temple.
Okay, Anita, thank you for your call, and thanks for being in a Bible study. That's great to hear people in there wanting to learn more about God's written word. Jimmy, we are out of time for other calls, so but I'm sure you'll be back on the program again very, very soon.
And yeah, and Mark, I know Mark Brumley will do a great job next hour for everybody.
He will. Mark is always good on the program, and we thank you, Jimmy, for your time today, as always. And I want to invite Maria in Virginia. And Brian and Matt and Linda and Scott, all of you, if you can hold on through the top of the hour break, you know how it works. We have 2 hours of Q&A open forum here on Thursday. So if you've got the time, please stay there on the line. You will absolutely, definitely, guaranteed get on the program. I am Jerry Usher in for Cy Kellett today. And a reminder that you can catch me and Debbie Giorgiani on many of these EWTN affiliates on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie. That is at noon Eastern Time, Monday through Friday, and the show encores at midnight Eastern Time. So I hope that you can tune in and join us on that program. Don't forget, now is a great time, actually, if you want to get that free ebook from Catholic Answers. And it's called Growing Closer to God, What is the Interior Life? Make great reading and great spiritual growth enrichment any time of the year, especially with Lent coming up. So just go to the Catholic Answers Facebook page, or you can get it in the shop at Catholic.com. Growing Closer to God, What is the Interior Life? Okay, it's something that's important for all of us, and that free ebook is available to you right now. Mark Brumley coming up, so please stay with us here on Catholic Answers Live.